Blog Talk Radio.
Jesus was a working man. He worked with his rusty tools all day. Packed his lunch and he did his job. Worked long hours for his pay. He walked to work each and every morn. Didn't drive a fancy truck. He'd hitch a ride on a camel or an ass if they had just a little luck. Jesus was a working man. He had muscles of steel and calloused hands. Always had a master plan. Yeah, Jesus was a working man. He could have been a priest or a businessman, knowledgeable tycoon. But he chose to live a simple life, and he slept beneath the moon. He worked livestock on his uncle's farm. He was a carpenter, and he made tents. He built fine boats with two strong arms to buy groceries and pay the rent. Jesus was a working man. He had muscles of steel and calloused hands. Always had a master plan. Yeah, Jesus was a working man.
Talking, we're country, we're Texas here at the Cosmic Citizen. This is Andre. We got a guest from Texas this morning too, don't we? We sure do. Hey, Paula, you there?
Yes, I am.
Well,
yeehaw.
I'll tell you, how you doing, y'all? We got to get ourselves some barbecue. I bet she can cook us up some mighty fine barbecue. I just have a feeling that would be the case. Well, folks, anyway, I could do that the whole show, you know? I could just do like,
yeah.
I could just... That would be...
You're doing well.
That would be a pretty scary prospect, wouldn't it? This is Andre Traversa with Paula Thompson. I'm the Cosmic Citizen. And like you said, Paula, we're going country here. I'm the Cosmic Citizen. And our guest is someone who is from Texas. She's a longtime Urantia book reader. I think she's been reading for at least for about 30 years. Our guest is Nancy Johnson. Nancy Johnson published an article in the summer 2009 issue of the Fellowship Herald, called The Role of Feelings and Emotions on an Evolutionary World. Nancy, thank you for coming on to our show. I really appreciate you being on.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. This is a great topic. I love it because, you know what, so many things I want to say. Let's just start with how you begin your article. You say, you know, you think that there should be a, you wonder if there ever had been a conference, a Urantia conference put together to discuss the role of feelings and emotions on an evolutionary world. And you have not, you said you've never heard of such a thing, but, you know, maybe it happened. But, you know, don't you think that would be a good topic for a conference?
I think it would be an excellent topic for a conference. What about you, Paula?
Oh, I agree. And, you know, I've just thoroughly enjoyed your article, and I love the the quotes you pulled out from the book that support, you know, your where you're going with this, and that is the role of human emotions in our evolution, and that they've been around for a long time, and that they're critical to evolving. And I really thoroughly enjoyed it, Nancy, and I, you know, and I want to add to our dear friends that Nancy is a long, long time reader, and has done tremendous service in the Urantia movement. Laid out the Urantia book, I think, what, two times at least, Nancy?
Yeah.
In double column format, and I just want to honor your many, many years of stalwart and devoted service to the Urantia revelation. Thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you for saying so, and allow me to turn that back on you and Andre. You've both, you know, that's what we do. We volunteer.
Yeah, we do.
That's what religious inspiration does for us, huh?
You know, one of the things that I want to kind of get into here, Nancy, is, you know, I think some people think that emotions are bad. They think that, if I actually even heard your Urantia book readers say this. I've heard some people say, you know, that because there's a place in the book where it says something about, in fact, you can even look it up, Paula, where it says something about people are most spiritual and receptive when they are, it's the mind of perfect poise, you know, and balanced neural energies. And so I've actually heard someone interpret that as saying that we should never express emotions. I mean, actually, I've heard people say that, and it's almost like they think we should be like Mr. Spock. And I would say that, you know, to me, emotions are like fire. You can start a fire and blow things up, or you can build a fire, you know. And I just, you know, emotions, don't you think that emotions can even be our servants if we know how to manage them and channel them properly?
Well, not just can be, but are.
Absolutely.
Whether we acknowledge it, recognize it or not, they are.
Mm.
By the way, there are pages and pages of quotes referring to Jesus' emotions, his human emotions. So, yes.
Well, that's a good point, and I think it's really important to remember that, because I think that that's what I told this person. I said, you know, Jesus expressed emotion.
Yes, he did.
Well, and you know it all.
He did it in a self-controlled way, but he did it.
It also says that the angels feel all, almost all, of our non-sensual emotions, right?
Yes.
So except for fear. Fear is the only one they don't feel, which to me is very understandable because they're not in a material body.
Exactly.
And they don't feel pain. Really, fear is just remembered pain. I mean, you know, when you've been hurt so badly, then that's what causes fear. You know what pain is. You're in a physical body. Anybody that's been in a physical body knows what pain is and probably would be afraid, you know, or experience fear to some degree.
And isn't it essential to survival, to our survival instinct?
Absolutely.
That's what fear is meant for. It's to save us. It supports our survival instinct. But it wasn't intended for us to use as a basis for making life decisions.
No, but you know what? I'm glad you're saying this, Nancy, that it's because, again, I think some Urantia readers think fear is always a bad thing, and it's not. It's actually, in fact, I love what you say, Paula, about fear. You say that fear is like an alarm clock. You know, we need it at times. We don't want to have it on all the time, but, you know, we need to make sure that it's there so we can use it properly. But I think, you know, there's actually a book that came out, Nancy, I don't know if you're aware of this, a book came out in the 90s called The Gift of Fear. And I forgot who wrote it, but basically the point of the author was, look, you know, fear, there's a reason for it. You know, especially I think he was talking to people who, you know, might feel something weird in their gut about a person they're getting involved with, for example, that might, you know, might be abusive or might be, and that's where, you know, that fear, that feeling of fear, maybe it can be a warning signal.
Yes, it can. And we should appreciate it for that reason. And other reasons, too. It gave birth to religion. Primitive fear gave birth to evolutionary religion.
That's one of the quotes you offer in your article.
Uh-huh.
And that coupled with, what's the other thing, Nancy? They said fear coupled with something, I can't remember now, gave birth to, you know, was the first religious experience. Gosh, I can't remember now how I put it. But
I could search.
Well, I have your article right here too. But there was you listed actually what amazed me is in all of the quotes you listed a whole range of emotions. I mean, just on and on really about various things that humans feel: pity, shame, reproach, love, hate, revenge. You know, and you can just see how they're a dichotomy. I mean, they're almost like two sides of the same coin.
Yes, but would you, why don't you read that, Paula? It's such an excellent paragraph. It includes all that range of emotions that we all feel, and it would be nice to read the whole thing the way they expressed it. Is that okay to do that?
Well, sure, I'm happy to do that. Here's the quote from Nancy's article. It's from the book. I'd have to look it up to tell everybody exactly where it can be found, but it says, many new emotions early appeared in these human twins. They experienced admiration for both objects and other beings and exhibited considerable vanity. But the most remarkable advance in emotional development was the sudden appearance of a new group of really human feelings, the worshipful group, embracing awe, reverence, humility, and even a primitive form of gratitude. Fear joined with ignorance of natural phenomena, that's what it was, Nancy. Fear joined with ignorance of natural phenomena is about to give birth to primitive religion. Not only were such feelings manifested in these primitive humans, but many more highly evolved sentiments were also present in rudimentary form. They were mildly cognizant of pity, shame, and reproach, and were acutely conscious of love, hate, and revenge, being also susceptible to marked feelings of jealousy. So that's two paragraphs, but that covers quite a gamut of human emotions.
Well, and Nancy, I want to make sure you jump in. I want to make sure you talk about it. I just have to interject here because this is such an interesting paragraph. These two paragraphs are interesting to me because I think the reason I mentioned that some of your anthropic readers don't like emotion is because they'll read passages like, it's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Well, that may be true. Your feelings may not lead you Godward, but once you are being led Godward, I certainly think that, you know, expressing that through your feelings is perfectly appropriate. And I think that they're looking fondly on the fact that human beings develop these emotions of worship. The other thing, one of the last things you read there, Paul, I don't remember exactly what it is, but we'll get to it again. But as I said before, I think that, you know, feelings can be a byproduct of thoughts that we do.
Actually, Andre, it does say elsewhere that we must feelingly experience.
That's right.
And that's the exact wording, feelingly experience it. And if we haven't got love of God, well, love is an emotion, but our religious experience isn't real until we have feelingly experienced it.
I wonder if that's really a word, feelingly. That's the only place I've ever seen that word. But
well, yes, of course. That's the beauty of English language. You can make it do anything you want it to do.
That's so true.
Mm-hmm. We had a boy in our study group one time, and he said, and he was from Colombia, and he said, well, what's so wonderful about your language is you just make up new words however you need to. For instance, if somebody has been in an accident, they just helicopter the person over to the hospital. So helicopter
becomes
is
a
not
verb,
a verb,
yeah.
But they change it to a verb because it says what they want to say. I like that language.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I gotta share a quote with you too that Lou just posted on the board, and it's going right along with this. It says Jesus taught the appeal to the emotions as the technique of arresting and focusing the intellectual attention. He designated the mind thus aroused and quickened as the gateway to the soul. Isn't that a wonderful quote?
I love it. Yes.
Thanks, Lou. Thanks for that.
Who was that?
Lou Bartolomeo, he's the quote meister on the board. He, you know, I thought I was good, but Lou's got me beat.
All right, Lou. Well,
anyway,
that is a gateway, and you can get people into a mood to just suddenly be uplifted into a more spiritual realm. Have you ever had the casual conversation with someone and you're just, you know, commenting on this, using a little flattery, and I don't mean artificial flattery, but a little complimentary statement here and there to relax the person, uplift the person, and then you can move into spiritual thoughts a lot easier. It is a gateway.
That's so true.
It works very well. And when I was a counselor on the Crisis Intervention Center, I know people would call in crisis, some emotional crisis, and I would let them ramble on however long they had to, just acknowledging what they said but not having any opinion about it, occasionally asking for clarification of something, let them go on and on. And as they got more and more confident that I wasn't going to condemn them for what they were thinking or feeling or what they had done with their lives, they would tell me more and more. So when they were finished telling me and they still didn't get chewed out, they would start talking about God. Now, we weren't supposed to bring up that subject, but they always did.
Huh.
If they were in crisis, if they were able to relieve themselves of that crisis in a non-threatening environment and still be okay with the person they're talking to, they think of God. And they had, I would ask them then to tell me, well, what are your concepts of God? For one thing, they did not like a hellfire and damnation approach to deity. That's what turned them away, off, and into mischief many times. And I would say, well, then, how do you see God? What is he to you? He must be something to you. What would you think God would be? And they would come forth with the loftiest concepts of God. It almost put me to shame.
Oh, my.
I really had high feelings. So I decided then and there that no matter how poor a life someone had lived, you know, the poor decisions they had made, they're wallowing in it, they still think high thoughts. And I wouldn't give up on anybody. No matter how bad they seem on the surface, underneath, when you peel away the layers, they're still that child that God created.
You know, Nancy, you touched on something so important, and before we go on, I want to tell Andre. Andre, if you need to leave the room and clear your throat, my friend, go ahead.
Okay, I'm okay now.
Okay, I'll hold the fort down for you anytime, buddy.
That's fine, thanks.
Anyway, I wanted to point out that you made such a valuable point, and this is a technique of ministry that Jesus used, and that is just listening, and listening in a non-threatening way to allow people to just kind of open up and pour their hearts out. And you know, I think that it's the lack of judgment, you know, where they're waiting for you to say, you know, now that they're you know, what a bad person they are, and you don't say that. You just listen and you just hear them out and you let them unburden their heart. And then that leads them to God, and then the things that they would say about the God of their dreams. And, you know, often I think that these notions of punishment and of worthlessness, condemnation, makes people feel like, well, I've already, you know, I've already wrecked my soul. I'm already going to go to hell, so I might as well live it up. What, you know, God, and I've heard this from people many times, because they really buy into this thing, and they've got it pounded into them that they're worthless, and they have a hard time believing sometimes that God really values them and loves them for who they are, mm-hmm. and forgives them for any stupid thing that they think they've done. Have you found that to be true?
Well, yes, and I laugh and ask them if they have a couple of days. I'll tell them about some of the stupid things I did. You know, we all do stupid things. That's a part of the growth process.
Yeah, that's true. And those emotions, I mean, it's interesting because emotions can be like a roller coaster, and we can use them against each other. And I think that's kind of what some people are getting at, you know, like to play on a person's emotions, especially religiously. But gee, isn't that what's happening all the time when they try to frighten you into the kingdom of heaven? Are they not playing on the basis of human emotions,
yeah,
animal fear?
And
but I also think a lot of times people who do that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just continuing a thought that Paula had brought up. If they're frightening you into the kingdom, that means they are using condemnation, which doesn't help at all because it just makes you feel worse.
Well, not just that, but I also think I think people who frighten people, I think they themselves are afraid in most cases.
Probably.
You know, unless it's a, yeah, I mean, I think that's in my experience at least. But, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up was that, going back to the whole thing about feelingly experiencing things, you know, one thing, and this is not so true anymore, I've found your Urantia Book readers now that I can pray with and talk and share my experiences with. But, you know, when I first got into the Urantia movement 25 years ago, it was very difficult for me to find a lot of people who, a lot of the people I talked to were just, the book was just an intellectual exercise for a lot of people. I go to study groups and there was no talk about your personal relationship with God. It was just studying the book from a purely intellectual, clinical point of view. And I guess I want to say this, and I said this on the air, the Urantia book is not a substitute for a relationship with God. And I think that's one of the things that they're talking about, feelingly experiencing things. You know, until we get that relationship with God down into our hearts, down into our guts, you know, it's just a head trip. You know, there's Christians have a phrase, head knowledge and heart knowledge. We need both.
Yes, because that constitutes balance. I mean, if we are to become balanced, which we're told over again we must do, or that is our goal to try to achieve that, that's what it takes.
Well, what does Jesus say? He says we need to love God with your heart, soul, and mind. Now, I don't know when he says the soul, I'm not sure exactly. Maybe he's just referring to the higher Urantia self, but, you know, heart and mind are definitely part of the picture.
Yes. And, you know, heart being love, but soul, that's who we're to identify with, is our soul, because that's what survives.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever just kind of talk to your soul and say, I'm with you. I am you. You are me. I want to be you more often instead of just my material ego self. And I'm not abhorring my material ego self because this body is what gets me around. It's my experiencing mechanism. And without it, I wouldn't grow much, would I? How do you feel about your body being your experiencing mechanism? It is a mechanism, not a person. Your soul is you. But the soul can't experience anything except through the body that it's
mm-hmm.
attached to.
Mm-hmm.
So taking good care of that body is a very good idea.
And isn't it interesting, though, then that reminds me of what we just read about the emotion of vanity.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly vanity is tied to that material body, right? And maybe not entirely. I mean, people can be vain about their own intellect. They can be vain about some talent they have. They certainly are vain about their body, and oftentimes. And when they're young, obviously, and then as they get older, they realize, what is the point in being vain about this? You know?
Yes.
but it makes me think that these emotions are almost always a double-edged sword, that, you know, on one hand, they can lead you to a good, in a good way, and that is to say, you know, I want to look nice, I want to be presentable, I want to look fit and healthy, I want to embody the values that I stand for, that I hold dear. On the other hand, you can say, I want to be attractive, I want people to, you know, to be attracted to me, or because I'm so beautiful, and it can go on the negative side of, and any emotion you can think of, it's just like Andre said, you know, actually, I didn't say that, Andre, about the alarm clock. That was my good friend Steve McIntosh.
Oh, really? He said that. Boy, I wish I, you know, I didn't get a chance to hear that show. I should. Really, he sounds like a, someone I'd like to talk to someday.
I've loved talking to him for many years. But, you know, yeah, he said that, and it's something I always remember. Fear is like an alarm clock. You know, you can use it to, as a wake-up call, but you don't want to let it keep going off in your head. And I think there again, you have the emotion. There's a good side to it. It was like Nancy said earlier, it's survival. But the bad side is you can become paranoid, ridden, you know, fear-ridden. Just your whole life can be ruined by too much fear, you know, and worry and that kind of thing. So, you know, these emotions definitely are a double-edged sword, I think.
And what about guilt?
There you go.
It goes right in there with it. I've pondered guilt for the longest time. Guilt was that there was something that we as a group, we were studying something, and guilt was an ego trip. And that didn't make any sense, and yet it did make sense. It's a sneaky one. Because when you're feeling guilty, I know what it was. A girl who was present told about an experience they had over the weekend. She and her husband had gone in their camper, and they were out, and they stopped at this place with a lovely pond, and other people around with campers were there. Children were playing. Everybody was having a good time. She had been reading in the book and just was having a, oh, you know, epiphany after epiphany, and she was feeling very elevated. And then she looked outside, and there were children chasing the ducks that had come up out of the water. That is, they were frightening the ducks. They were chasing them, scaring them. She watched them. She got very upset about those children doing that to the ducks, and no parents out there telling them to stop doing that. And she went outside and scolded them. And then one of the parents came out and scolded her in return. Well, then she went from her spiritual high down to that low, low, low place that you get when things didn't go well. And she was feeling so guilty about it, it just ruined the rest of the weekend. I said, and that is why guilt is so dangerous, because you could have turned that around. You could have done something really positive when those children started abusing the ducks. It could have been a wonderful lesson. The parent, you could have turned a wonderful lesson around on them. But when you're feeling guilty about something you did, you are unable to act at anything. You can't. You're just frozen.
Well, I think there's a difference. I like the distinction between guilt and shame. That's a distinction that was made by Jonathan Bradshaw, I think, firstly. He's
yes,
a,
let's hear that.
I'm sorry?
I said, yes, let's hear that. I want to hear that.
Yeah, there's a because I don't think guilt is all bad. I think guilt, the distinction that Bradshaw makes between guilt and shame is guilt is the idea I've done something wrong. I screwed up. Shame says I am a mistake. It's not just that what I did was wrong.
Excellent.
You know, I'm a bad person because I did something wrong. And I think that's a distinction that I think is important. Because I think guilt does have a place. I don't think it's all wrong. It's all a bad thing. I think a certain amount of people who don't feel any guilt, we call them sociopaths. They have no conscience. So I think with guilt, it's like anything else. A, you can blow it out of proportion. Because I've been doing that recently with something in my life. I've been blowing something out of probably blowing something out of proportion. But I also find that sometimes remorse. I think remorse is a better word. A certain amount of remorse leads to repentance, and it leads us to, you know, it should lead us to repentance and to
right.
change our ways. But I think that when it becomes a constructive use of remorse is when we say, okay, I need to do something. I need to make amends for what I did. Okay, that's constructive. It's destructive when we just wallow in it. You know?
Yes, and that is the tendency when we're not very mature. We feel guilty, we get stuck in it, and we don't move forward. We just sit there or become gray matter, gray.
I think what happens...
Black, but, and not bright, like spiritual brightness, but just gray, you know.
Well, I think what happens with me, I think that's why it's so dangerous, I think, to be isolated. Oh. You know, the Arantra book talks about the dangers of isolation and that we don't confide in other people. We don't confide in people, we don't get perspective on our situation, and we don't take it to the Lord in prayer. You know, that's another thing. If we just sit around by ourselves and continue to indulge the guilt, then we blow it way out of proportion. It becomes bigger than it really is, and then it becomes overwhelming.
Well, and a lot of times humans are a partner in that guilt, too. I mean, parents and teachers and ministers and people who have an influence over us use guilt, again, just like fear, as a weapon to get you in line, right, to create a desired result. But they go too far. And it's like Jesus said, you know, guilt, actually too much guilt dished out to you by those people who are influential in your life or even by yourself can bring about low self-esteem. And Jesus said that we would stop at nothing to restore the self-esteem of someone who's lost it. Why? Because it brings about what Nancy was talking about, a paralysis of the will. Brings about this place where you are absolutely afraid to act because you're just sure you'll do the exact wrong thing. And you know what? Compared to God, you probably will, but God needs you to act because, as Jesus also said, experience is the master teacher. The master teacher. I can tell you this and tell you that, and somebody else and a teacher and a minister and all kinds of people can tell you things all day long. But experience will teach us all. And so I think that's why God needs us to act, and he needs us to understand that it's okay if it's not perfect. It won't be perfect. But
it won't be, and it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
And we all need to take that attitude with each other. I mean, yeah, some people, Andre, you're right, some people do things that are absolutely unconscionable, and they are broken human beings. I mean, they don't have a sense of guilt anymore. But I think even that probably comes from somebody who has beat them up so bad for so long that they have rejected every notion of sensibility about what's right and wrong.
Well, I think it has multiple causes. I think that's one cause of it. I think trauma is definitely a cause of it. I think that's someone who's never been bonded. You know, if they've never bonded with anybody, they never had any real parenting. You know, you don't know how to love unless you've received love. And if they haven't received love, but I also think there probably are some genetic anomalies of people who are just born crooked, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, a sociopath could very well be born that way. Something that didn't come together in the brain correctly.
Right.
Because
we know the Arantxa book tells us that genetics does play large in those kinds of positions. So.
Yeah.
Can't say that it's all the parents' fault or somebody's fault that a person turned out to be a sociopath or a psychopath even, but we know that the genetics plays pretty large in those kinds of things too. Antisocial behaviors, I think, is how the Arantxa book terms them.
Yeah.
And, but again, the sense of guilt is a natural emotion, and it can be used. I mean, You can help a child feel remorse for having done something wrong. But Andre, I think you're absolutely right. You shouldn't make it be about that child. That child is not bad. It's like saying, you know, Jesus loved the sinner but hated the sin. You have to make that distinction that a person is not what they do, you know. I think Jesus again said, you know, make not the mistake of estimating the soul's worth by a single unfortunate human episode.
Mm, that's a really great statement. That is a really good, I love it when you bring these quotes out, Paul, because they just really bring me a lot of perspective on things, because I've been dealing with some personal things on that regard too, and it just makes me feel a lot better.
Here you go. Here's the quote. It's from paper 156, The Sojourn at Tyre and Sidon, section 5, Jesus teaching at Tyre. He says, make not the mistake of estimating the soul's worth by the imperfections of the mind or by the appetites of the body. Judge not the soul, nor evaluate its destiny by the standard of a single unfortunate human episode. Your spiritual destiny is conditioned only by your spiritual longings and purposes.
Hmm. So it's all about where we're going, not what we've done.
Well, yeah.
It is. Where we're going and not where we've gone. But do you know what, Andre? I can recall to this day and frequently remember it. When I was a little girl, I said something hurtful to a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt so bad after I did that.
Mm-hmm.
That I've used it as a lesson all my life not to do that. You know, because I personally do not like that feeling of feeling so bad because I hurt somebody. So that one I carry with me because I don't want to forget it. I don't ever want to do that again. But it's not like I wallow in the shame, but I just don't want to do that again. That really felt bad. Have you ever done that? You know, just felt so bad because you said something to or about someone and it was unfair and you just feel bad. Well, I did that. I did it twice.
You know what, Nancy? I'm going to go one step farther and say that I think we all do feel really bad when we do something stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing we probably need is somebody trying to make us feel worse.
That's true.
In fact, most often we need somebody to say, look, don't feel so bad. Everybody makes mistakes. And especially with a child, you know, a lot of times children, like you said, will hold that in and they'll keep that. I have a similar experience. I've had many experiences like that in life where I think, oh my gosh. And our dear friend Ann Garner told me once, you know, Christians will say, Lord, put a stay on my tongue.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't inadvertently say anything that's going to hurt somebody. And I'm such a verbal person that I really learned to count on that, and I make it a blanket prayer to the Heavenly Father, Father, please, you know, put a stay on my tongue. Just don't let me go there, because the last thing I ever want to do is hurt somebody.
Well,
you know, that makes me feel so bad. I mean, I feel awful if I hurt somebody, and it's so acute. And I think most humans have that, that sense of remorse. Most normal humans have that sense of remorse where they really feel bad if they've hurt somebody. I don't meet many people who like to hurt people.
Well, you know what, Nancy and Paula, I wanted to say something about both of you, though. I think it's here I go again about the positive side of guilt, because I don't encourage neurotic guilt or false guilt. But I think, Nancy, I think it's a good thing that you felt that way, that you felt bad. I mean, that's a sign that you are a person with a conscience. It's a sign that your thought adjuster is working. So that what I'm saying is kudos to you. That's a reflection on you that's something that you don't want to do. And same to you, Paula. I mean, those are good. You know, again, I'm not encouraging the guilt. I'm just saying it's a good quality. It's good that you can feel that.
Well, it's good that you're not. Good to remember that I too do these things, so I don't need to be judgmental about somebody else.
Right.
Because I've done some dumb stuff myself.
Right.
But there's just a good side to all this. I know. when you have done something hurtful to someone and you feel that awful ache inside, there are things you can do to turn that around. And I'm thinking, okay, when I said the hurtful thing to the girl, I don't recall that I ever told her I was sorry.
Oh, you don't recall? Okay, okay.
I think if I had gone to her and just gave her a hug and said, I'm sorry. That was just, I just should not have done that. She would have felt better.
Right.
And I would have felt better.
Right.
But since I didn't do the right thing then, I just carry the memory around with me. I don't flog myself over it. That's just wasted energy. But I just use it as a reminder now and then. Be careful here. Be careful here. And I'll use that the rest of my life. I think it's a worthwhile thing to do. But I'd rather correct the mistake. That is another thing that it taught me, to correct it if you can. Reverse it if you can.
You know, I have to share something with you guys because it was just so touching to me. I don't know if either of you have heard Condor play at a Urantia conference, but they're a Native American group, and the woman, her name is Teresa Doolittle, and she's the sweetest soul, and I had the most wonderful conversation with her. They go around and they play at elementary schools. And she told me, she said, you know, because I am Native American, she said, and because we come to share our culture, it opens a door for us to share our spirituality. She said, it's really a rare privilege given to somebody who performs for an elementary school because our spirituality is commonly believed to be part of our culture. And she said, so they allow us to share that way. And
wow.
She said, after we do a performance, she said, many times I have an opportunity to talk to students that are there. And she said, I always remember, this one little boy who kind of grabbed me and pulled me aside and poured his heart out about something that he had done that he felt really bad about. And she said, I gave him a bit of Native American wisdom. She said, I told him, my grandmother used to tell me, whenever you do something, she said, whenever you make a wrong turn, make two right turns, one to correct the wrong and one just for growth.
Oh, that's cute. One just
Isn't
for growth.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's good.
And she told me that's a philosophy that I have always used in my life that my grandmother shared with me.
Well, then can't we all do that? Isn't that something that we ought to spread around, just to be aware? That's a mind trigger. It's something you can remember and remember in a flash when you've done something wrong. Take a right turn and then take another one.
Right.
I think if we did that in life as we took this little wrong turn, we could take the right turn and then do one more, and then you've not only corrected the situation, but you have turned it into a positive. Excellent advice. Well,
yeah,
put that in the next publication, okay?
Okay.
A little filler quote, you know? That's a good filler quote.
Yeah, it is, and it's, I'm a person who loves words, Nancy, just like you said. I love language. I love words. And all my life, excuse me, I love poetry. I love great old adages, words of wisdom, you know. And that, so when I hear one like that, it's sticky. It really stays with me. But I think it is sticky with all of us because if it wasn't, we wouldn't have handed them down all these years from generation to generation, these old adages of wisdom, you know.
That's true. There's a prayer, speaking of this, it's a different subject, but there is a phrase of a prayer that rings in my mind. It's probably the most perfect prayer I can pray, other than that one that they use in AA, God help me too. to serve rather than be served. That one.
Yeah, that's the prayer of Saint Francis.
The prayer of Saint Anthony. Yeah. But this other one is just a starting of a prayer, and when I get there, I don't feel like I need to pray any further. I just need to stop there and be there. And it's lift up our minds and our hearts, O Holy Spirit. It's just the opening phrase of a prayer that I learned as a child, and I don't know where it came from. I don't remember who first told it to me. But when I say that, there's this pause in me that just wants to be there, you know, with my, to allow my mind and my heart to be lifted. But what a prayer for the world. Lift up our minds and our hearts.
You know, and I pray that often. I it's funny you should say that, because I ask the Father to lift us up. Lift us up. It seems like we're mired to me. If I look at humanity through a spiritual lens, it just seems to me like we're mired in the muck. And, you know, talk about these emotions. It seems like we're mired in the base ones of guilt and shame and blame and doubt and fear. And I often tell people, you know, Jesus said, you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. Well, what will it make you free of? Do you ever wonder about that? What will the truth make you free of? Because, you know, a lot of people come up and they say, you want to know the truth? The truth is you're going to hell.
Yeah.
Oh, gee, that really is liberating.
That makes you feel good, doesn't it?
And yeah,
free.
I feel so liberated now. Isn't that truth?
Well, that's why, you know, what that means, what that says to me, Paula, is, you know, a lot of people will say things like, oh, I'll tell the truth even if it hurts. Well, in a lot of cases, it's not the truth. It's just their opinion, and they think it's true. And so they, you know.
That's right. And when the truth makes you free, when you learn the truth, I think what that means is you learn to see through a lens that's many faceted. That is, you're not seeing it from a single perspective,
mm-hmm.
but you're seeing it from a many-faceted perspective, which is God's perspective, because he sees it for all the things that it can and will be. It's not a material vision. It's a spiritual vision, the truth that will make you free. You get to see things from a higher perspective.
Right. Someone on the board, Bro Dave on the board, just said, free of ignorance and free of error. Those are both wonderful. Actually, Kevin said free of ignorance, and Bro Dave said free of error. And that's so true. You know, the truth will free you from so much.
Yes.
And that's what lifts us, Nancy, getting back to what you said, lifts us up and makes us, you know, light and buoyant, and gives us joy. There's a great emotion. How about joy as
yes.
an emotion?
Yes.
Let's go for some joy.
Okay. Now, what's the opposite of joy? Let's get down to primitive emotions, because we're born with all these things.
Well, the opposite of joy is sorrow.
Yeah, sorrow, sadness. Well, actually, any of the negative emotions rob us of joy, don't they? So how do you turn a negative into a joyful positive?
Well, I think one way to do it is by allowing yourself to feel it. Because sometimes, I've talked about this in the air a lot, about how I'm a conflict resolver. Okay, I'm not one of these people that likes to sweep things under the rug. And I don't feel at peace until I've resolved something. Okay, and to me, a lot of what that means to me is working through something, working through the emotions, feeling, allowing myself to feel whatever it is I need to be feeling. And if it's something I need to resolve with other people, make sure I make it, you know, make sure I resolve it. But don't just pretend, you know. When you talk about how to, like, I find that if I work through those negative emotions and get them out of my system and find out what they're about, then I can feel that joy.
Okay. How do you do it, Paula?
What occurs to me is something you said earlier. And something Andre said, too, just moments ago about contemplating God and talking it over with God. You know, why do I feel this way? And many times I ask the Father to take it away from me. I say, you know, being a mother, obviously, you get a lot of fear, especially when you have children in this world. And, you just are struck. I mean, sometimes my heart just freezes with fear for my children. And I'll immediately pray and say, Father, please take this fear away from me. I don't want to live my life in fear. I don't want this to rob me of the joy that I can have in this moment. You know, I refuse to live in fear. Or sometimes when I have a thought of, like a primitive thought, you know, superstition, where you think, well, you know, I'm afraid to believe that, you know, everything seems to be going pretty good, but knock on wood, you know. And I'll again say to the Heavenly Father, please take this superstition away from me. I know this is nonsense. I know that nothing can harm me. And I just affirm my faith. In that moment that I, you know, have that emotion, I immediately try to affirm my faith. So that.
So in a sense, you're saying that that is a joy brought about by worshipfulness, a worshipful attitude, because you
right.
are being worshipful when you ask such a gift. And
yes.
It is, you know, take this away. That would be asking for a gift. I have a thing that I do, and I'm sure both of you do too, but you just didn't think to say so. Doing something for somebody else.
Oh.
You know, saying something that makes somebody else happy. Helping someone in need. All of those simple things as you pass by. You know, you're walking along, going through the checkout stand at the grocery store. You know, some poor checker's just had it today, and she's ready to go home. And you just say something nice to her, and she smiles. And I know that the next three people that she waits on are going to get some pretty good service because it lasts about that long. Just dropping little kindnesses and doing something for somebody else. That brings me joy. I just feel good when I do that, and I want to go click my heels and dance a little bit.
You guys,
I'm weird. That was a strange thing to say. Am I weird?
No, you're not weird at all. Service obviously is a wonderful antidote for in what does the book say? Harmful introspection, you know.
Yes, it is. Isn't
yeah,
it?
Absolutely. Hey, you guys, the board is telling me that I am in cutting out and in some ways unintelligible. So I'm going to hang up and call back in. I think you two will still be able to talk, though.
Yeah, although you're starting to sound better.
Yes, even as we speak, you are sounding
yes.
better.
Okay, well,
it was
I'll
static.
Hang in there for a minute and see if it's better.
Okay, I don't know that it's gone, but it certainly is better.
Okay.
Does that mean when, see, I'm not familiar with the technicalities of this. When we hear static coming from you, does that mean it goes out over the radio waves too?
I think so, yeah.
Ah, okay. All right. So, Andre, what kind of services do you enjoy doing that bring you joy, you know?
Oh, what kind of services? Oh, boy. That's a really good question. Well, this show is a service.
Yes, it is.
And I'm glad by the way that you said about talk about bringing joy, because I really believe one of the things I love, my understanding of the Urantia book, is that service is not supposed to be a sacrifice. It's not supposed to be a grudging duty. That service ultimately should be something we enjoy. And I don't get me wrong. I'm not saying there are times when we have to do something for people. Sometimes we really maybe we don't feel that great about doing it, but it's something we need to do. Especially, I think of my family members in particular. There are times, you know, when my grandmother was alive, God bless her. There were times when she was sick at the end of her life. There were times when I really didn't want to do certain things for her, but I ended up doing it anyway. But having said that, I think in most cases, I believe that serving others should be a joyful experience. I mean, Jesus says all kinds of things about that. He says the Ranch book says Jesus didn't teach self-denial. He taught only self-forgetting. He says, you know, it's a privilege, not a duty, to serve the Lord. If you look at, interestingly, you know, in the Urantia book, it talks about going the second mile, but it's got a very interesting way of looking at what going the second mile means. I think for a lot of Christians, they think going the second mile means making a sacrifice, you know, going out of your, you know, making, you know, doing the more difficult thing.
Whereas
in the Urantia book, going the second mile means not just doing something out of duty, out of compulsion, but doing it because you really want to. And I think that's, you know, that's the attitude towards service that I want to have. And I hope that, you know, and if I'm not having that attitude, it's either because it's an occasional fluke, or it could be that, you know, I need to reevaluate what I'm doing, and or reevaluate, you know, maybe I need a retreat and take some time out with God or something. But, you know, I think that, yeah, I personally want my service to be, I want service to be a joyful thing, most by and large.
Okay, so service then is a socialized emotion. It's a mature attitude toward God's creation. It's a cosmic consciousness type of thing, right? Wanting to do service, being service motivated. And I think there are so many things in our, let's go to vanity in our emotions. Now, vanity. There was something about vanity and that cluster of emotions that leads to art. Isn't that wonderful? Uh-huh. It leads, and when you, say, have a talent, let's say you're a singer, and you want to sing for people. Well, that can be a service, right? But if you sing to please an audience, how wonderful. If you sing to get praise from the audience, that's a lower emotion. But a higher emotion is to sing to bring joy to an audience.
Sure.
And you got to have an audience to show off your talents. So being a piece of audience is a service.
Right. I think we don't need to beat ourselves up, though, if we have a, but I mean, because, you know, we can enjoy, there's nothing wrong with enjoying the praise, as long as we don't do it only for that reason. Because the fact is, we're all going to have mixed motives. And yeah, I think that, you know, we're not all going to be pure right now. But I think that there's something that you said that I wanted to get back to. It wasn't something you said, it was something I was thinking of. Because I think that, I think we may have a distorted view of what it means to be unselfish. Being unselfish doesn't mean that we can't get anything out of it. You know, there was a philosopher named Immanuel Kant, who I thought had a really sort of strange notion of ethics. He said that if you are kind to people because you enjoy being kind to them, that sort of takes away from the purity of the act of kindness. He thinks that ethical acts should only be based on duty alone, and it should only be because it's your duty to be kind. And if you feel good about it, and if it makes you feel good, well, then somehow that
it's sinful.
Well, yeah, he said that corrupts it. He said that was, and I thought it was sort of silly because, but I think that comes out of a distorted notion that somehow if you're getting something out of it, if you're enjoying it, well, then that makes it selfish, and that assumes that you can't enjoy being unselfish. That somehow that makes it selfish. No, I think it's only selfish if you're doing it at someone else's expense, if you're doing something at somebody else's expense. But, you know, just because you get something out of it, that doesn't make it selfish.
Well, no, and we have a quote to support that, reward follows effort. Throughout the universe, reward mm-hmm. follows effort.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put out the effort to assist someone, just because you are moved to do so and you see the need and you feel it, that should make you feel good. If it doesn't make you feel good, there's something wrong.
Yes, I agree with you.
Absolutely. And I have to point out that, from your article, the great quote about the tribe of Andon and Fanta, and they go on to say, well, let me just read the quote that you use, Nancy. They say, they were a wonderful tribe. The males would fight heroically for the safety of their mates and their offspring. The females were affectionately devoted to their children. But the patriotism was wholly limited to the immediate clan. They were very loyal to their families. They would die without question in defense of their children. But they were not able to grasp the idea of trying to make the world a better place for their grandchildren. Altruism was as yet unborn in the human heart, notwithstanding that all of the emotions essential to the birth of religion were already present in these Urantia aborigines. And what we've just been talking about is altruism, And in different forms. Like, for instance, sometimes if I'm sharing something that's beautiful to me, whether it be a work of art, a poem, a song, my reward is that I've pleased someone else because of altruism. Mm-hmm. It's not about me. It's about doing something that makes someone else feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my reward.
That's
so
that also makes you feel good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it makes
me part of the reward.
I made them feel good. That's the point. I feel good, just like we were saying earlier. I feel bad if I make them feel bad, but I feel good.
Exactly.
I can help them feel good.
You know, I actually.
And guess which one I'd rather be addicted to.
Well, you know what? I actually heard a minister or somebody say this to me back when I was a freshman in high school. And I remember from this day forward, and I really thought it made a lot of sense. He said, "You know how we do good things for other people?" And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because it makes us feel good after we do them." And I think that's healthy. That's good. It should make us feel good. It's better that we feel good for doing good things than feel good for doing bad things, you know. And so, I mean, I think what Jesus was concerned about was maybe it's the level of good feeling. Do we feel good? Why are we feeling good? Are we feeling good because people can admire us and say, "Oh, you're such a wonderful person," or are we feeling good because we really touched someone else's life? You know, that's the difference. I think what Jesus was concerned about was with the Pharisees, who, you know, and some of the other people. You know, they wanted to be seen as being do-gooders. You know, because that was the people thought they were holy. You know.
Yes, and hopefully we've grown past that, but people still do it, don't they?
Of course. Yeah. We're very immature. We're still very, very, very immature. This planet is very immature. I'm going to give us another, I don't know.
Well, you know what, Andre? Things are getting so bad right now that it's encouraging me.
That's a great statement.
And I'll tell you why. Because I have been saying for some years that people are not any worse than they ever were, because if you look back in history, people were pretty cruel to slaves and what have you. Their punishment, everything was pretty cruel. And so I don't think people are any worse now than they were, but a lot of people are better than they've ever been.
I agree.
And it makes the contrast. See, we see it because we're seeing it from a higher perspective, and so it looks worse. Well, that's a good sign. I mean, it means that we have come to a point where we can see things from a higher perspective. It makes the bad look bad or worse, but it isn't really any worse than it's ever been.
Well, you got on one of my favorite topics, and it's kind of a tangent, but it's something that I think we can bring it back to what we're talking about, and that is that one of the things I disagree with some of my friends about is they talk about the good old days. Please. No good old days, you know. Like, come on. I mean, you know, I can go on and on about how bad things were back then. I mean, you know, I've heard people try to. I mean, and we realize the fact that some things are getting better and some things are getting worse. But overall, I would argue that a lot of things are getting better. One of the things that I think is getting better, you talk in your article, Nancy, about the importance of psychology, okay, and how the Urantia book has so many great psychological insights, and I think psychology and therapy. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying they're the salvation of human, but I think they are one of the most important tools that we have today. And I think it's I think it is responsible for leaps and bounds in our civilization. Because let's just take parenting. I'm not saying that all parents are better parents today, but parents have the opportunity today to be better parents than they ever had before, because they have 12-step programs, they have seminars, they have self-help books. They can parent consciously. They can break the cycle of dysfunction if they grew up with a dysfunctional family. They're not just a slave to whatever their parents did or their grandparents. And there's so much help available today. And I just think that's a wonderful thing.
I do, too. It's exciting to me.
Well, you know, and talk about the good old days. I mean, I remember when I was a child. It was really nothing, and I have to preface this by saying I think it's good to remember how far we've come, even in the last 50 years with human rights, with the rights of children, and that's my point, that when I was a child, it was nothing to see a parent just wallop his child right on the street, you know, or in the grocery store, just, you know, and I remember seeing that quite a bit as a child. and corporal punishment was meted out in public schools pretty regularly.
Well, yeah,
you know,
it was. The ruler on the fingers, as I recall, they used to say, the principal or somebody go around whacking your fingers for misbehaving or something.
That gives a lot of power to teachers. I had a bad experience as a child in first grade with a teacher who would pull my hair.
But it does make you fear authority. And
right.
If you fear authority and you become, let's say you're a male with lots of testosterone and you become a teenager and you're almost big enough to leave home and you start feeling your oats, it's like you want to kick back. And I think an awful lot of lawbreaking goes on among teenagers because they resent the authority that they were exposed to when they were growing up. What do you think?
Oh, I agree. I think it foments rebellion, really, when it is so unreasonable. And what I have found with children, up until the age of 5, sometimes you may have to use something that they won't forget to keep them safe. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Keep them from running out into the street.
Yes.
But once they get their thought adjuster, you can reason with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they become very reasonable. And so it's not necessary to use those kinds of tactics. And even before that, it's not necessary to be severe. You know, children are very sensitive creatures, and people are. You know, I really think in general, humanity is way, way, way too severe on each other.
Oh, absolutely. See, I would argue that even before a child is a thought adjuster, though, I think that you may not be able to reason, but you can, for example, I think you can teach things like gratitude and empathy, you know, rather than just teaching a child to say thank you. I think you can actually, I believe you can actually teach a child to really be grateful, and you look for teachable moments. You say things like, if a child gets a toy that they really like, you can sit down with them and say, you know, you're really excited about that toy, aren't you? You know, and they can say, yeah, and you can say, yeah, they really like it, let's talk about it a little bit, you know, and then you can say, you know, I'm going to teach you a new word. You know, this is what we say when we're really excited about something that someone did for us. We say thank you, you know, or, you know, let's say they throw a block at their little brother or whatever, you know, you can say, you know, that, you know, did you see that hurt Johnny or whatever, you know, and they say, you know, and you can say, how do you think that made him feel? I mean, there's a lot, there are things you can do, I believe, that really make it so that a person isn't just going through the motions. You know, you can actually, I believe you can actually teach these things so that they become a part of a child's heart.
Well, I believe you can too, and I do think our modern psychology has called so much attention to this to so many people that they are gradually absorbing it. They still react in many ways to those primitive emotions and react in a primitive way. But many people are learning not to do that anymore, that we do have control. I think transactional analysis, you know, I'm okay, you're okay. When that concept was introduced back, let's just say, 1970, I don't think people thought they had that much choice over their behavior patterns, their reactions.
Which concept are you talking about?
Transactional analysis.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm okay, you're okay, remember?
Right.
And Eric Byrne with his What Do You Say After You Say Hello? I don't think people had given too much thought to the possibility that they could change things or that they do things because it's the pattern they learned when they were young and the tapes in their head tell them to do that they can actually change the tapes in their head. So psychology has come a long, long way. And thank heaven, because, as I say, the good is getting so much better that it just makes the bad look worse by contrast, you know.
Well, and again, you know, psychology, you know, is teaching us how fragile is the human psyche.
Well, that's true, too, yes.
Well, I think it's teaching us that it's fragile and strong at the same time. Sometimes we're more fragile than we think, and sometimes we're stronger than we think we are, too. I remember reading in M. Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled. He says we're actually mentally healthier than we think we are. A lot of times we're actually mentally healthier. He's surprised at how we're actually at how mentally healthy we actually are, that we should be a lot sicker.
Well, and we probably should be. And those who capitalize on that are, you know, yeah, think about some of these things. The emotionally frail, sometimes that's their racket. It gets them what they want.
Yeah. Well, that's true. They learn how to use it as a weapon. But I do think that the psyche of a child is fragile.
Yeah.
And it's also impressionable.
Yeah.
It's like a blank slate.
Yeah, they're very impressionable. And what did they say in the book with that quote, that they are, children are more impressed by your loyalties than by what you say. So if we say, do this, and we show that what our loyalty is to selfish things, then they're going to learn the selfish traits and not the do this that you tell them to do. Do you remember that statement? I thought about that for a long, long time. They learn from the loyalties of their parents, not from their words.
Right. Well, it's kind of, it also, I mean, it's like I said sometime earlier on the show, I said, you know, that you can't love unless you've received love. So that's the other thing. You know, it's what's been modeled.
Uh-huh. That's true. You learn what you live.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
A statement that somebody made once. Yes. So we have all of the reasons to elevate our human emotions, and we can elevate them to something highly spiritual. I better clarify that. I would not consciously attempt to elevate any of my emotions to be considered spiritual. I think there's the problem of vanity in that one. But we can, nevertheless, elevate our emotions by our desire to do good to others and having fun doing it and enjoying the rewards and wanting to do it more and more. Those are the things that we do with our primitive little emotions. We elevate them, and society gets elevated as a result.
Right, and imagine if we couldn't feel. I mean, let's go to the other extreme now and imagine that we have no emotions, that we were unemotional, that we can't feel. That means that we have no empathy, no compassion.
That's right. That's
because
right. I think
it's only our ability to feel that allows us to put ourselves in the place of another human being, and
that's exactly
really
right.
Is
that's what I would say to some of these readers I was talking to who think we should never express emotions. And when the Rancher book says Jesus was moved with compassion, what do you think that means? I mean, that's an emotion. In fact, I would argue if we couldn't feel anything, we couldn't be spiritual.
That's right. We couldn't be so many things without these emotions. Gosh, I want to be emotional, but I don't want to be emotional. Does that make sense?
Sure.
I don't want to be reactive. I want
right.
to be an actor.
Right, right.
Or proactive.
And wouldn't you agree that sometimes we all get, I shouldn't say we all, sometimes people get addicted to negative emotions rather than reaching for a higher emotion. Like, you know, they get addicted to fear or they get addicted to drama, conflict, turmoil.
Adrenaline.
Adrenaline, yes,
and
adrenaline.
The thing that drives it, yes.
And instead of, you know, turning that around and saying, okay, let's transmute that into a positive direction and get addicted to feeling joy when we make someone else feel better. Ministry, service, these
yeah.
higher levels, because they bring about a very high emotion, a very positive emotion then, that's fulfilling and satisfying. It may take effort, but the result is an emotion that's very satisfying to us. And
well, I think
sometimes, you know, we're addicted to these negative emotions because it makes us feel, at least we feel something. We feel alive, right? We get adrenaline, as you said, Nancy, or something. It evokes some kind of reaction in us, which makes us feel alive.
Well,
but,
this makes me remind me of anger, because I think of my father, unfortunately. He was addicted to anger, and I think the reason, and I do think there is an appropriate place for anger at times, but I think that in a lot of cases, the reason I think people often would prefer to feel angry is because anger is an easier emotion to feel. I believe it's a secondary emotion, not a primary emotion. There's a great acronym that I remember seeing. The acronym was GIFT, okay? And so when people feel angry, they are either feeling guilt, inferiority, fear, or trauma. And that was a really great thing. So anger, what anger is, it's like a surface emotion, and we need to look beyond it to see what the root is. And I think that for a lot of people, it's too painful. It's easier for them to just stay angry because it gives them the illusion they're in control. I'm angry. I'm going to kick some butt here. I'm going to, you know, whatever. When what they really may be feeling is something that's much more vulnerable, that makes them, you know, that they don't want to, because it's too painful and they're too afraid to express it because they're afraid that, you know, they might be rejected or whatever.
Well, here's a thought for you, Andre. In our culture, especially in America, it's not appropriate for men to feel many emotions.
Of course
not. Men especially aren't allowed to feel the whole gamut of emotions that women are. You know, I think you'll agree, Nancy, women are lucky in that we don't have any such repressive mores put on us. But men, one of the only emotions that they are allowed to feel is anger.
Mm-hmm. And aggression.
Right.
That's right. And that's what they do when that's what they live, because they learn what they live.
And they are emotional beings, and that's the point. They are emotional beings. We all are, and they have to express this emotion somehow. And if you take away their right to be sorrowful, then what does that leave them? Not much, really.
I always encourage, I had four boys and a girl that I raised, and if they wanted to cry, that was okay with me.
Mm-hmm.
I just tell them, that's okay, honey. Go ahead and cry if you want to, because sometimes you just need to cry. And it was okay. And to this day, two of them just, you know, can cry easily. And two of them don't. The oldest one just hardly ever cries, but the number three son will occasionally. But I had two boys who cry. They cry when they're happy. They cry when they love, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Well, that reminds me of something, too. So we're talking about parenting. I don't mean to criticize parents, but one of the things that bothers me that some parents do is when a child cries, they'll say, let them cry it out. They won't comfort the child. Because they think the child should just cry by themselves until, you know, and that concerns me. This kind of reminds me of what some parents do when a child is having a temper tantrum. You know, they want to punish a child from having it, but a lot of times that's just the only way the child knows how to express their feelings. And so I think the right thing to do, and I realize this is not always possible, and so I don't mean to be so idealistic, but I think the right thing to do in most cases, if a little child, a little toddler is having a temper tantrum, you know, the right thing to do is to pick them up and say, "What's wrong?" They need to be calmed down. Yelling at them or smacking them is not going to calm them down.
No. But, you know, you bring up something that I learned in my years with preschool child development. You know about the terrible twos.
Right.
You heard about that. Well, as I sort through the meaning of life and the different stages of life, what's the purpose of the terrible twos? And it begins with, that's when they first learn to say no.
Of course.
And when they say no back to you when you're telling them to do something, you're confronted with something you need to resolve. It so often just turns into a power struggle between parent and child. And I think the purpose of the terrible twos is to nurture your children into taking no for an answer. Now, I say nurture your children, because if they say no and you say, I said yes, you know, if you stand there with your hands on your hips, that's a power struggle.
Right.
I'm talking about something much gentler, no reaction to the fact that they said no, except to let them talk about it and take no for an answer, because if you can't get them to take no for an answer, they will get past this stage, but it will resurface when they are teenagers. And
well, yes,
can't bar the door.
And you know what? You know what? And I've not been a parent, but I would love to be one. And one of the things that I think happens too is that I mentioned Jonathan Bradshaw earlier. If anybody's ever heard of him, he was a great speaker. He hasn't been around for a while, but he used to speak on addiction and family issues and stuff. And, you know, sometimes parents will take it personally when the kid says no. They're like, don't talk that way to me. You know, don't talk back to me or whatever.
Challenging my authority.
I'm sorry?
I said, you're challenging my authority.
Right, right. but the interesting thing that Jonathan Bradshaw says, he says, it's important for children to learn to say no. Because if they don't ever know how to say no, then they might become, you know, subject to peer pressure. They might become addicted to drugs or whatever. You know, saying no is very important. That's why even Dr. Dr. James Dobson, who's a fundamentalist Christian, he wrote a book called The Strong-Willed Child. And in his book, even he says, strong-willed children are actually, in a lot of ways, healthier than the compliant kids, because he said that they're the ones who can buck the peer group when they get older. So, you know, parents should be happy that they have a strong-willed child. Sometimes, you know, that you get, the idea there is to maybe channel that, you know, properly, but not to, it's not a bad thing.
So there's a... an adjustment in what I said and what you said, because we can merge those two so that we have a balanced use of the word no.
Mm-hmm.
They do need to take no for an answer, because there are things they cannot do.
Right, and right, right. Right. They need limits. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And they also need to learn how to decide. What?
They need to learn how to decide. They need to learn that they have choices and they have a will.
That's right.
And they can have
a good way to teach them, yes.
Right.
Well, that's
you know, I wanted to bring up the point, too, that oftentimes we stifle emotions in children because we are uncomfortable with those emotions ourselves.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we don't want, I mean, you know, many times, I mean, I've had men tell me this, don't cry, don't cry. You know why they say that? They're afraid that they'll start to cry.
Right, right. They're uncomfortable with it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if we just embrace our own humanness, and instead of trying to stop each other from feeling, embrace those feelings, those emotions, and say, you know, I'm sorry you feel bad. How can I help? You know, instead of being uncomfortable. Go ahead, Nancy. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, is there anything we can do to help? Because very often when someone is crying, there isn't anything we can do to help except to be there and let it be okay and
right.
be a friend. And, you know, that's probably one of the biggest services that we can provide for our fellow men, because that's the one we'll see the most often. Just be there for them and not have an opinion about what they're feeling. Excellent point you brought up there. We are afraid of our emotions, you know? It's silly. I'm not an emotional person either. I have to confess that I'm not a crier and I'm not tender feeling. It's kind of hard to hurt my feelings because I don't take it personally. It just kind of bounces off of me. But I
That's
want,
just
Yeah, and we that's a good thing to learn, of course. I don't want to become hardened because I feel that way, but
right.
But I do like it that I'm just naturally that way. It's not something that I fought to learn. I'm just not that emotional a person. So some people are. I have other things that other people don't have, you know, that I had to learn to get a handle on. And to moderate. Oh, I had lots of things I had to moderate, but I'm so old now I kind of forgot how many there were and what I did to moderate them. I remember in my 30s when I went through my righteous indignation stage.
Mm.
My boys were being exposed to the new era, you know, the 60s. People are starting to get pretty free with a lot of things that weren't free before, and drugs came into being, and oh my, yes, I got into my righteous indignation thing. And then in my 40s, when I was 40, I found the Urantia book, and that was most useful because it helped me get past the righteous indignation thing, which was a reaction, not an intelligent reaction, just a reaction, you know, a knee-jerk thing. I dare anybody to do this, or how could, you know, to get on my soapbox and shout and stuff like that. Well, I didn't need to do that anymore after I read the Urantia book. It's kind of hard for me to remember sometimes who I was before I found the Urantia book, because I'm quite different now.
Mm.
Do you feel that way? I mean, do you feel any different? Or?
Well, I found it at such a young age. I found it at 14, so.
Oh, yeah, I wish I'd had it then. But before I raised my children. As it turns out, my children were, even the youngest one was a teenager when I found the Urantia book. So I missed those early years. I think I'd have done some stuff better, but when would I have found time to read the book? You know, working and raising five children takes a lot of time.
My, oh, my, you said a mouthful right there. But, you know, and I have to say, Nancy, I guess I was blessed because I found it when I was 20. In fact, I know I was blessed when my daughter, my first child, was a year old. And it's changed me so much. I mean, a broadened perspective,
mm-hmm.
to
yes.
see things in a different light, to see things in a different way. To not be a victim of the, you know, we were saying earlier, you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. To be liberated from those, you know, those things that kind of hold you back and hold you down into this narrow, circumscribed reality that
yeah.
you're a prisoner of,
mm-hmm.
is such a blessing that especially when you're raising children and, you know, speaking of which, here's my little grandson, Andy. Yes.
Oh. Oh, boy.
Oh, I love his voice. Is there anything more precious than a child? I just can't even imagine.
I can't either. It's just, I have 13 grandchildren now and 3.5 great-grandchildren.
Wow.
So that's a bunch of family, and I just love them to pieces until all the little boys converge here and turn my house upside down, and I can't see, so I don't know where they put anything, and it takes me a week to find it.
So what? I'm sorry, Paula. How are we doing on time here?
Well, we've got 32 minutes still on.
Okay.
We're doing.
Has anybody? You know what? I want to give our phone number. We haven't even given our phone number out on the air here yet. 716-646-8158. That's 716-646-8158. Having a good show here, I think. I think we're just talking about feelings and how they relate to our spiritual growth and our spirituality, and that's always a good thing. So it's kind of a little Saturday morning therapy session here on the Cosmic Citizen. We do a lot of different things here. And this is one of those.
Here's your chance, folks. Call us and vent your emotions.
That's right.
Think it would be really nice if some listener out there had a slant, a contribution to make from a different perspective, something that maybe the rest of us aren't thinking of, and it would be like, wow, what an insight.
Yeah.
I'd also like to hear if someone has overcome something in a very interesting way. Even in an ordinary way, just to overcome anything is pretty wonderful.
It is. You know, because we can become prisoners of our emotions too, and we really do need to learn to overcome them. I think that was the point that you just made, Nancy, that sometimes, you know, it's a blessing to not be so sensitive
that you can't let some things roll off your back. And for me, I was a very sensitive person as a child, and I think that was accentuated by the fact that my siblings picked on me quite a bit. I was the youngest in my family. I was, in fact, I think, a victim of sibling abuse, and that really over-accentuated my sense of indignation about somebody picking on me. And it took many, many years to learn to let that go. In fact, I have to be honest, it wasn't the Urantia book that helped me with that. It was the Course in Miracles that did. The Course in Miracles really, really helped me to let go of what other people are thinking about me. It doesn't matter.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I support that one too. I'm so glad it came. I think there, you know, one is, I think I did a conference thing one time and asked the question, is A Course in Miracles an addendum to the Urantia book? I think it is.
Well, that's very interesting. It's very interesting to hear you say that, because I know we're kind of on a different topic here. But you know what's interesting about that, Nancy? I don't want to get into
it's okay.
whether the Course in Miracles. I have a hard time relating to the Course, but I will say something interesting. You're one of the most interesting Course in Miracles readers I know, because a lot of Course in Miracles readers that I know take that kind of attitude toward emotions. Like, they'll say, well, you know, guilt and fear are illusions, and we shouldn't indulge them. Or they'll say things like, you know, that they don't have any place. My uncle's an example of that. He's a Course in Miracles reader, and I told him, for example, that sometimes I need to protect myself from certain people because they're abusive or they hurt me. And he basically, he'll say, well, you're just choosing to be hurt. The point I'm making in all this is simply that I think it's really refreshing to hear your perspective as a Course in Miracles reader, because you must have a different perspective on the Course than some people do, because you acknowledge these realities. You don't gloss over them.
Yeah, in fact, one thing that I do about maybe that's different from other readers of A Course in Miracles is dealing with ego. I'm okay with the fact that I have ego.
Uh-huh.
Because that's associated with my material body. We talked about that earlier. I am my soul that lives in my body. And my body has a mind, or a brain at least. I guess it has material mind. My soul probably has a more spiritualized mind. And I just need to train my ego to be a good horse. I think of my soul as being the rider and my body as being the horse, the transportation vehicle, the experiencing vehicle. So I just want to teach my body to be helpful to my soul so it can experience the things it needs to experience. But I'm okay with having an ego.
Right.
I just need to train it to be a good vehicle, you know?
Well, and you know, I think that for me, and I mentioned this to Andre, I think part of the difference is if you read the Urantia book and then the Course in Miracles, you get a bit of a different insight from the Course than you get if you don't read the Urantia book and just the Course. That's what I've noticed anyway.
Yes, and I've also noticed that people who read the Course first and then read the Urantia book see things in the Urantia book that those of us who read it first didn't see. We read past it. Because when I typed the Urantia book years ago, I had just finished reading the text. I read the teacher's manual and the text of A Course in Miracles in December and started typing the Urantia book in January. So 1 month later, so it's all fresh in my mind. And, of course, when you're typing, you're going slower than when you're reading, because you can read faster than you can type. So I had to slow down. And in the slowing down of my thoughts, there was time for these comparisons to sandwich in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I saw things. I read things differently because I had time to read it differently and to see it differently. I would say, oh, I wonder about I wonder if we have been misreading that. This gives me a different perspective if I read it through the eyes of A Course in Miracles.
Can I ask you, it's so funny that we're on this topic, because it's kind of, I know it's getting away kind of from where we were, but you got me so interested. I'd love to do a show on this whole topic sometime, just how reconciling the Arantxa book with the Course, because some people think they're irreconcilable. And again, I'm asking you out of with the most profound respect, because I really do respect you. I'm not asking this as critically. I'm asking this as a friendly challenge. I'd love to hear your response. In the Course, it says, in the Arantxa book, it says, perfection is not our origin, it's our destiny. Okay? And my understanding of the Course, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but my understanding of the Course is that the Course teaches that we are already perfect. We just need to recognize it. And that's why I always had a hard time with the Course. And I just kind of wondered how you reconciled those two, or do you see those things as conflicting, or do you see them as complementing each other? Because my understanding of the Arantxa book is that, you know, we're not perfect yet. You know, we're immature right now. We're going to be perfect, you know.
Yes, and I think that the ego mind would misinterpret that statement.
Which statement?
That we're perfect.
Oh, okay.
Because we misinterpret it in this way. We have a thought adjuster, right?
Right.
Guess who's perfect?
The thought adjuster.
Right.
Okay.
The soul is born of our good deeds and none of our erroneous deeds. Okay? So if we identify with our soul and know that our eternity and our personality situation is going to be melded between the thought adjuster and the soul, that's perfect. I don't have a problem with that.
But even when we survive and go into the next life, in the Arantxa life, our soul survives, but our soul still isn't perfect yet.
No, it has a long way to go.
Right.
But see, there's this thing called other than perfect.
Okay.
All right. A baby is born. Well, that's a perfect little creature, isn't it?
Well, it's an innocent creature.
That's right. So if I wanted to say it's perfect, I can say that. And in my material mind, I can interpret it that way, you know, that it's perfect. My material mind interprets things in a material way. My spirit mind sees things from a higher perspective. So I can resolve it in my mind, but I don't know if others have resolved it in theirs or how they resolved it, because different people resolve ideas in different ways. Am I making very good sense here? I don't like for someone to excuse all of their misbehavior by saying we're perfect. No, I can't buy that.
No, and it's not reasonable, but I think that, you know, I don't think that we can dismiss anything that people find of value, even if we don't find it of value.
Yeah, there is a lot of value in a course.
What, Nancy?
I say there is a lot of value in A Course in Miracles, and I'm so glad, even though I hated every minute that I read it, I just, you know, I never doubted God. Why is he going on and on and on about this? You know, well, then I learned later who was the human subject, and then it made perfectly good sense that he would talk to her that way, because she's a clinical psychologist. And her mind, which never sleeps, is challenging everything he says. And he just keeps whittling away at her objections. That, you know, I don't know if that makes sense to you, but if you can remember reading it, he just keeps saying things over and over and over again, but slightly different each time. I think that was just how he had to win Helen over.
You know, maybe it's not the Course itself that's the problem. Maybe the problem is that the Course is often interpreted in a new agey kind of way. What I mean by that is one of the things I hear from a lot of people in certain New Age circles is, I don't actually hear this so much. Well, I'll hear things like this. They'll say, you're responsible for your thoughts. You're responsible for your feelings. Or they'll say, they'll act as if you can control every thought you have or every feeling you have. And I just don't think that's true, unfortunately.
Well, that's pretty darn near true.
I'm sorry?
It's pretty darn near
true. Oh, you think it is?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, that's one of the, in fact, I've actually, it's one of the most profound things that was ever said to me. In fact, I'll say who said it to me. Crystal and Deke's brother David said it to me. You know what he said to me? What
did he say?
He said, you can't help how you feel. And I think that's true in the short term. Now, it's not true in the long term. Okay? In other words, eventually you can help how you feel. You can eventually, your feelings, your emotions mature. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a, you can't, I mean, sometimes I'll have crazy thoughts that come into my mind. I can't control every thought that comes into my mind. And thoughts are kind of like birds that fly over the nest, but I can control what I put into my mind, and I can control what I dwell on. So I think I can have indirect control, but I can't have direct. I don't think that, there's a lot of stuff that you know, a lot of stuff that we feel. But one of the things that's helped me a lot, Nancy and Paula, is that I realize that I am not my thoughts. I am not my feelings. So sometimes I'll have some crazy thought, like, you know, I wish someone was dead, or some stupid thing like that. And I realize, you know, that's not, I don't really mean that. That's just, you know, sometimes feelings and thoughts just happen to us.
Well, that they do, but you see, to say you can control your thoughts, your what you said about in the long term, yes, you can. The fact that something pops up into your head could be from whatever, you know, maybe it's something from a movie that you saw years ago and forgot that you saw. No problem. It's just, how long do you entertain it? Is it destructive, or is it like taking a little vacation, or, you know, thoughts are not bad unless you make them bad, and you can control that.
100%. Well, sure. Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that that's a process, though. It's not like a...
Right.
It's not something that you can just control by forcing yourself, you know, trying to force yourself to think differently. I'm not a big believer in willpower. I think it's kind of I think it's often like trying to get out of quicksand, you know, but I think that you can, let's put it this way, the more we grow spiritually, the more mature we become, hopefully the more our thoughts, you know, mature.
Mm-hmm. You know that statement you said, I'm not my feelings, I'm not my thoughts, that was a part of the EST training that I took.
Okay.
Do you know anybody who ever took the EST training?
No, but I know a little bit about it. I know. I also think about Landmark Forum, too, which...
it was a harsh training program.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't subscribe to all of it, but for some reason or other, for years, I knew that I had to take that training. And I'd already found the Urantia book before it came to Dallas and I could take the training. But when I went there, you know, you got these two harsh weekends just really uncomfortable, physically uncomfortable, because you just have to sit there in one place, and I'm not used to sitting in one place. And I work nights, and now all of a sudden I have to be awake days. So it was difficult for me to endure it. But the last night, man, I got just exactly what I wanted when I went there. It had to do with the mind. I can't explain it. It's just a personal, you know, a way my mind works. But it was seeing the mind in a way that I hadn't seen it before, and it was worth the whole two weekends just to get that picture. So that's one of the things they said, though. You're not your feelings. You're not even your mind, because mind is everywhere, and it belongs. It's a gift, you know, and we all have mind, and we all use the same mind, but a different variation of the same mind. So we're not any of those things. We are God, as far as I can tell. When I wade through everything, this is God out here experiencing himself and his way of saying...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, I think I know what you mean when you say that now, that God is... Because, well, I don't like to say we are God, but I'll say God... I like what Dave Eldridge says, is God is becoming us, you know, which is what the thought adjuster does. The thought adjuster becomes us because it gets our personality. But, you know, as far as the thoughts and, you know, I'm not my thoughts, I'm not my feelings, well, first of all, the reason that helps me a lot is because it makes me feel less guilty. Because sometimes I've had really crazy thoughts and I felt really guilty about it. And I realized, you know what, I was like, why did I even have that thought in the first place? You know, and I was like, you know what, it's just because it just came to you. Sometimes, though, I think it's important to look at why a thought came into our head, because sometimes there can be some real, you know, we want to think about a negative thought, but there may be some meaning behind it. Like, let's say a person has suicidal thoughts. You know, that could mean that a part of themselves needs to die. You know, there are a lot of things, you know, or one thing I like to point out, you know, let's say we really resent someone. A lot of times I find that the person I really resent someone because, let's say that person said something that hurt me, okay? Well, if I didn't love that person and if I didn't care about that person, I wouldn't have been hurt by what they said. You know, so sometimes, you know, if we look beneath the surface, we can see there's gold underneath all the horse manure, you know.
Well, and that's true. There usually is a great deal. Is this a case of the truth setting you free? When you see through all the mire,
right?
All of a sudden it's clear, and it sets you free. So I'm thinking that these are things of psychology coming to head now. I'm not my feelings. I'm not my thoughts. I'm not my ego, which is the material self. You are only temporarily your material self. You won't be that forever. As soon as you die, that material self is gone.
I'm sorry, Paula, I've been monopolizing the last few minutes here. I'm sorry. I really kind of got on a roll here. The material self, though, correct me if I'm wrong, well, our material body doesn't survive, but I would think that certain things about my material self contribute I contribute certain things from my material self to my soul. You know, and sometimes my thoughts and my feelings are a reflection of who I am. I guess that's really what I'm saying. My thoughts and feelings are a mixed bag for me. Sometimes they are just, you know, junk, but sometimes they really are a reflection of who I really am. So I think it's just a case by case situation.
Well, and that's the human condition, you know. You're both, and what you do is live every day. And back when I could drive, I'd be going down the highway, and I'd say, "Well, God, what are we going to do today?" It's fun. I made it a game, and I like playing games. So it was. Looking at the car, the oncoming cars, well, where are you going with them today? What are they going to be doing? What are we going to learn today? What do you want to do? And live each day that way. So then I become our thoughts, right? I have my own silly, quirky nature, my human sense of humor, and then there's God, who wants to experience himself, and we're just going to work together. We're partners.
And you know what? I get the sense that he loves that. He loves being your partner, my partner, Andre's partner, all of our partner. He has an exact plan to get us to paradise. He's working out the details day by day by day, step by step by step, and he's enjoying every minute of it. You know, whatever the experience is, and we are unique and irreplaceable, right? The book, the Urantia book reiterates that in so many wonderful ways, that we are so precious to our Creator, and that He is truly experiencing the universe of universes through us in each unique, beautiful being. What a miracle that is. What a joyful thought it is to imagine that the Heavenly Father craves to share the inner life with us. He craves it. And that's why He's here with us. And really, literally, whither can we go that He is not? He is omnipresent. We are in Him. We literally live and move and have our being.
Yes, we do.
So, you know, we may not think every perfect thought, but He is there to adjust those thoughts.
There you go.
It's a true partnership. And we are not perfect. He is perfect. And there's a big gap to close there. But he's very patient. He's got all the time in eternity to get us there.
Yes.
All we have to do is show up and pay attention and be willing.
Now,
be willing to.
How about being your own, being a parent again? Come back down to earth, Andre. You said you would like to be a parent.
Yes,
now,
I would.
Just imagine
your child
wanting to have this fun relationship with you.
Wait, say that again.
Imagine that you have a child. And this child wants to have a fun relationship with you. Let's do things together, Dad.
Right.
Let's do things together, Mom. Even though they've gotten older, let's do things together.
Right.
Well, God enjoys it the same way.
Right.
You know, and isn't it amazing that we haven't had that concept for a lot longer than we have? It should have been around forever, because if we can imagine us feeling that way, surely we can imagine that God would feel that way. And you know it can't feel anything less.
Right, and likely infinitely more.
Yes.
You know, what I love is when I look at my precious little grandson, Andy, and I see, you know, the innocence there. And I say, what would I lay at his charge? You know, what blame would I put on him? He's just a child.
Uh-huh.
He's learning. He's growing.
Exactly.
Changing.
Exactly.
Well, God sees us in that exact way. I mean, we're talking about an infinite, eternal being compared to these little finite mortals that are essentially just spiritual embryos.
Exactly.
Right now.
Exactly. That's so great that you're saying that, Paul, because that's exactly why I don't buy into, you know, the atonement doctrine and things like that, because, you know, it says, you know, the atonement doctrine is based on the idea that you know, God demands perfection of us. And because we can't become perfect, the only way God can see us as perfect is if Jesus dies in our place and all that. But the thing is, I don't believe God does demand perfection of us eventually, but he doesn't demand that we be perfect now. That's like, that would be like us demanding a little baby become an adult, you know, right away. That's just crazy. You know, and a little baby that becomes an adult, how? By growing. Just by growing into one, not by forcing itself or trying to force itself to be an adult. I mean, what does it say in, you know, in the Arantia book, the best way to become a frog is to be a loyal tadpole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you guys...
So we need to quit saying he demands us. There's a lot that goes on in our languaging, and when we say...
Yeah, I don't like the word demand. I shouldn't have said that.
When people say to us that God demands that we be perfect... Well, that's not exactly the word that he would use. I'm sure.
Yeah, I agree.
He would say
I agree.
Something like, "I nurture you into becoming perfect,"
or God invites.
Or I invite you. I invite you.
Yeah, I invite you on this journey.
And it's your choice.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
You know, and Nancy, you quoted the book earlier about children being permanently impressed, and it just touches on what we just said. It's from paper 100, obviously. Great paper, Religion and Human Experience, Section 1, Religious Growth. It says, children are permanently impressed only by the loyalties of their adult associates. Precept, or even example, is not lastingly influential. Loyal persons are growing persons, and growth is an impressive and inspiring reality.
Mm.
Live loyally today. Grow. And tomorrow will attend to itself.
Right.
The quickest way for a tadpole to become a frog is to live loyally each moment as a tadpole.
Boy, isn't that
off of living? You know, we feel a lot of pressure to perform or what have you, but
right.
That just makes us want to relax into it, into growing, into being what we are today instead of what we... are supposed to become in 20 years or 100 years or a million.
Right, right.
You know, so yeah, it takes the pressure off.
Yeah.
Of it for me.
And by the way, Paula, I think we're running. Are we running out of time here? What is our?
We have a few minutes left, Andre.
Let me just say one thing. I'm so glad you. There's so much we can talk about, Nancy. We've got to get you back on the air because you're just great. One of the things that I wanted to it just reminds me of a quote by Viktor Frankl. I think I mentioned this on the air. He was talking about the people that the Catholic Church canonizes as saints. And he said, you know, they didn't become saints by trying to become saints, because that would make them perfectionists, not saints. So they became saints because they loved God, they loved their fellow man, and then sainthood was a byproduct. And that's the same thing with our perfection. You know, we don't become perfect because we try to push ourselves and become spiritual drill sergeants. That's not how we become it. We become perfect by just living one day at a time, resting in the arms of God, you know, letting it, just doing what he calls us to do one step at a time.
Perfect. And a perfect way to close the show.
Well, thank you, everyone, for being with us. That was Nancy Johnson. If you want to get her article, The Role of Feelings and Emotions on an Evolutionary World, you can get it from the summer 2009 issue of the Fellowship Herald. Now, Paula, is that available online, or do people have to subscribe to that?
Yes, it is. It's available at the Fellowship's website, www.yourranchabook.org, and just look for it under What's New. If you go there, he hasn't archived it yet. In the there's actually an archive of all the old editions of the journal, or the Herald. But if you want to find that one particularly, go to the section called What's New, and you'll find it right there at the very top.
Excellent. Okay, folks.
And you know, Andre, we still have 4 minutes. So
I thought we said we only had 1 minute left.
Oh, good, because I wanted to tell you, it's been fun. I wasn't sure how I would take to this, but if there's anything I do nonstop, it's talk. So I've had fun.
Well, that's why I knew you didn't need to be nervous. You would do a great job.
Well,
thank you
for inviting me.
Wonderful job. Thank you so much for coming.
And by the way, you know, there are a lot more pages of quotes, and I am more than happy to provide the rest of those quotes. That was just a little thimbleful, so to speak. There are a lot more quotes. I have the file. It's an electronic file in Microsoft Word, and I would be more than happy to forward that wherever necessary if someone wants to read all those quotes. I've kind of loosely organized them into subject matter. You know, we went through most of the primitive stuff today because that's really what it was about. But then there's the sex emotions and the angelic emotions and evolutionary.
I have trouble reading, right? Email you'd like me to publish so people can write you for that?
Oh, my email address is ncjohns, ncjohns, at tx.rr.com, TX being abbreviation for Texas.
Okay, tx.rr, okay. I just wrote it out so people will have it.
Okay.
Great.
Oh, and we have Jesus Emotions, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in there about Jesus' apostles and his associates while he was here, because they talk a lot about their emotions and feelings. So I've kind of sorted those out, too. And it's just clumping them, you know. It's loose, but it helps to organize them a little bit so you can find what you're looking for. Okay.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much, my dear. And also, before you go, I want to personally thank you for your tremendous work on the standard reference text.
Well, thank you.
And if people don't know what that is, a group of three from the Urantia Book Fellowship representing Uversa Press, and three from the Urantia Foundation representing Urantia Foundation's publications, got together and went through every typo, every change that's ever been made in the Urantia Book text, and there's not that many, but they went through every single one of them. They agreed on a standard reference text. It was monumental. It was a monumental effort, and from now on, anybody agrees to that text will have the same exact text that's being published by the publishers of the book. So
for the next printing, the next printing will be that text.
Yes.
It could be, yes. And remember, this could well be an ongoing thing because language changes, and it could be that this will be necessary. The committee has not been disbanded for that very reason, because things are coming up even as we speak. somebody says, oh, I ran across this. You might want to look at it and see if that's if that needs to be adjusted. But the beauty of the committee was that we all wanted it. We all wanted a standard text. And so the cooperation that you get in arriving at what is the most common sense solution here in each individual item in case, it wasn't who changes, who doesn't. It had nothing to do with that. It was just let's turn out the best work that we can possibly do because that's what we owe to the Revelators.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you so much, Nancy. And now we probably should close because we're down to just a few seconds left.
Okay, folks, stay with us. I'm not sure what we're having on next week yet, but I've got a couple of things lined up. We are going to do two shows. One of them is going to be on the 30th of January. We're having a debate between two anonymous people. We're just going to call them pro and con. It's going to be on the Urantia book, pro and con. One person who rejects the Urantia book, one who embraces it. So that should be a very interesting show. That will be on the 30th of January. Sometime before that, I'm going to do a show on global religious persecution around the world. We're going to have somebody from the Pew Research Center who's going to talk to us about the persecution that goes going on, all kinds of different religious persecution from by government.
Heavy topics.
Yes. So they'll be interesting. We'll be back to a little bit of controversy, but hopefully it'll be some controversy that will be interesting to everybody in our audience. So that would be that'll be very. You know, we'll look forward to that. So, in the meantime, we will talk with you guys soon.
All right, and thank you all you people behind the scenes who are doing whatever that I can't see you doing. Thank you for that support. Makes the show possible.
Sounds good.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Nancy. Thanks, Andre.
You're welcome, Paula. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book, so all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. If you would like more information about the Urantia Book, or if you just have comments or questions, please feel free to email us at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet, the letter X, N-E-T.com. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.